This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Lemieux, partial 2-on-1 across the line, makes a move. Lemieux back in behind the net, the wraparound. He scores! For Morrow, he moves in, out in front of the shot. They score! Backdoor Mason Appleton. Here's Lonnie across the line, moving in, shooting. Stop, rebound. They score! Brian Little knocked the rebound out of the air. Lemieux off a skate. He scores. Lemieux hustled to that rebound. It bounced off Yannick Weber and beats Pecorette. It's 5-1 Winnipeg, and this one should be salted away.
From Thursday night in Nashville, a montage of Winnipeg Jets goals put together by producer Sean Assor. It was a tremendous effort for the Winnipeg Jets going into Music City, defeating their chief rival. Can I say chief rival? Are the Predators the Jets' chief rival?
I would think so.
Yeah, I would go with that. I mean, all due respect to Minnesota,
absolutely,
but playoffs and everything else, I'd say the Preds are the chief rival. The Jets going into Nashville for the second time this year, and in one of, if not the most complete effort on the season, the Jets walk out of Nashville with a 5-1 victory on Thursday night, extending their winning streak to four straight games with an opportunity for a fifth consecutive win tonight in Dallas. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this morning at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Dave Minuk and Ezra Ginsberg. As I mentioned, producer Sean Assor doing a great job behind the board. We have 3 hours of Jets talk, 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. I say good morning to Ezra Ginsberg and to Dave Minuk. Gentlemen, nice to see you on Saturday, the 19th day of January.
Good morning. Also, it gives us a lot of time here to defrost.
It's chilly outside.
It's apparently minus 100 right now in Winnipeg.
It is not warm. It's certainly the deepest cold of the winter, I would suggest, so far.
It's so cold, Drew, that my knuckles are not only cracking, but they're bleeding.
You know, you can
I'm not joking.
Okay, so anybody that wants to get Ezzy some moisturizer for his birthday can certainly do that. You know, that's readily available in most of your neighborhood, you know, pharmacies, grocery stores, you know. Department stores.
I'm not a big moisturizer guy.
Well, that's how you prevent your knuckles from cracking and bleeding.
Hence the reason you have bleeding knuckles.
Yeah. Gloves would also help. I mean, were you wearing gloves this morning?
Yes.
Okay, well, I mean, these are all good things that'll prevent your hands from freezing
off.
I
have some great gloves from Mountain Equipment Co-op.
Okay.
Shout out, they do great work there.
Okay, I mean, that's good of you to do that. But moisturizer
would be my
suggestion.
The reason why I don't wear moisturizer, Drew, is because, you know, 98% of the year, I don't have to worry about my knuckles cracking and bleeding because it's minus 50 outside.
But I'm not saying you have to wear it every day, but when it's wintertime, it would be advisable. Dave, how are your knuckles?
They're smooth.
You're well manicured, well groomed. Nice to see Dave taking care of himself.
Yeah, I make sure I'm okay.
Yeah. When was the last time you had a mani-pedi? I feel like you had a mani-pedi a month ago.
This show's off to a great start.
I didn't have a manicure recently. I don't usually get manicures.
Was ixnay the manicure, eh?
But I had a pedicure in November, I believe.
Nice.
You know, I like to make sure that, you know, I'm well-groomed, and so that it's a nice treat. I do enjoy one. I have no qualms about saying that, in fact. It's a nice little treat to pamper yourself.
What about that crap they put on your feet? I don't really like that.
Moisturizer?
Is that what it is? I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Moving along.
Let's move on to the Jets and the Predators. It was a good week for the Winnipeg Jets. As I mentioned, four consecutive victories, which I believe is their longest winning streak of the season. Started, of course, the first victory was last Friday against the Red Wings. They came back to beat the Anaheim Ducks on last Sunday.
Nightmare on Helm Street.
Yes, that was last Friday. The Vegas Golden Knights were the next victim into Winnipeg on Tuesday night, and then in Nashville on Thursday with what I thought was the Jets' most complete, most dominant effort, the biggest statement win of the season, I would suggest, this thus far, Dave.
Yeah, and Ezzy and I were talking about it on the way down to the show, and I think anytime you're going to get contributions from your fourth line the way the Jets were able to do, you're putting yourself into a very good stead. So I think from that perspective, when you have Brandon Lemieux getting two goals, you have Mason Appleton scoring. I mean, Sammy Niku, well, he's not on the fourth line, but he's one of those, Joe Morrow, those kind of contributions. You're not reliant upon those first two lines. You know, you're putting yourself into a really good position to win a hockey game.
Precisely. I mean, if you had said at the beginning of that contest that the Jets, the only Jets forwards who aren't going to get any points are Kyle Connor, Mark Scheifele, and Blake Wheeler, and Adam Lowry. I mean, Adam Lowry may be in a little bit of a different category to him than the other three. You would have said the Jets are going to be in trouble. Instead, the top line gets 0 points, and the Jets roll to a victory where they got contributions up and down the lineup. And really, the depth is what showed, I thought, on Thursday night against the Predators.
Yeah, I mean, we know that both of these teams have excellent depth, right? The Preds have great depth as well. And when you're talking about, you know, some of their bottom forwards, guys like Rocco Grimaldi, they've been chipping in. Guys like Colton Sissons, Austin Watson. We talked to Justin Bradford on the Wednesday show, that third D pair, Dan Hamhuis and Yannick Weber. And I realize, you know, Yannick Weber didn't have the greatest night against the Jets on Thursday night. But the Preds have excellent depth too, Drew. But it was the Jets' depth that came through, right?
Mm-hmm.
Brendan Lemieux scores the wraparound goal. And we've talked about it a lot. Steve Valiquette, who's been on the station before, talks about how wraparound goals just don't seem to happen. But when you talk about the Jets, we've seen Buff score the wraparound goal. Earlier this year, we saw Tyler Myers score the wraparound goal, right? So Brendan Lemieux gets the ball rolling against Pekka Rinne. And, you know, we remember how Pekka Rinne played in the series against the Jets. And the big goal to me, guys, wasn't actually the Brian Little goal, and that was the goal I think that a lot of people kind of pointed to as being the goal that kind of put that game away.
Right, the goal late in the second period after the Preds had cut the lead in half.
To me, it was the Mason Appleton goal, Dave. And if you watch the replay, who does he beat on that goal? He beats Ryan Johansson to the net. And I thought that was a beautiful pass by Joe Morrow, and mm-hmm. Sammy Niku made a really nice play in the Preds zone before that. And, you know, talking about the fourth line, I mean, you know, Brendan Lemieux, Mason Appleton, these are guys that you didn't necessarily expect to be regular members of the Jets, but you have injuries to Nikolaj Ehlers, and prior to that you had an injury to Andrew Kopp, and Mason Appleton might be the most improved Jet on the team. I mean, I've talked about this a lot. I think when you're talking about Ben Sherratt and, you know, you're talking about Brandon Tanev, those are improved players as well, but I thought that goal by Mason Appleton was huge. I thought it took a lot of life out of the Preds, and back to what we were talking about before, the Jets were just better. I mean, they deserved that win. Connor Hellebuyck was excellent. I don't think he had to steal the game, but the Jets were clearly the better team. They deserved that one.
You mentioned Connor Hellebuyck, and you know, he didn't steal the game, but he was just the solid. It was more of a Connor Hellebuyck of last year. Solid, consistent.
Yep.
Calm, poised, and I thought he played with a bit of a chip on his shoulder, because, you know, I think always heard for the last week, 2 weeks, as much as he likes to, you know, pretend that you tune things out, is that how well Laurent Brossoit is playing, how Brossoit deserves more starts, and how great, you know, where would the Jets be without Brossoit? I think Connor Hellebuyck went into that game in Nashville and said, you know, I'm still the number one goalie. I'm the backbone of this team in net. I'm going to have one of those efforts, and it showed on the ice.
I think there was no question. I think he knew, especially, you know, you hear both guys talking, and you want both guys, look, they're both professional athletes. Both guys want to be in the net all the time. I mean, Laurent Brossoit knows his role, knows his position on this team, but, you know, he's hungry. You know, he's hungry for starts, and he's hungry for, you know, he's talked about it throughout the season. He was asked about it in the locker room a couple days ago when they were here still in Winnipeg and talking about playing with this season with a chip on his shoulder. So I don't think there's any question that he is out there to prove himself.
Mm-hmm.
I think similarly, though, when he was asked whether he was surprised to have gotten the start against Vegas, he admitted that he was a little surprised, but he was happy to have gotten it. And obviously, the coaching staff wanted Connor Hellebuyck to get a little more time between starts so he could have that rest period and then be ready for this game against Nashville. But Drew, I agree with you. I think there was no question that Connor Hellebuyck came into this game knowing he had to have a good game, knowing he needed to play with a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. And I think he did it. And I think, you know, it's to the Jets' benefit that they have both goalies going the way they are.
And Dave, I thought maybe the most impressive aspect of this game was this is coming at the end of a really tough stretch, right? And you think about it, you know, the 9 games in 16 days. But since that loss to Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
the Jets have had 7 games in 12 days.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to have 8 games in 14 days with Dallas.
A busy stretch of the season.
They've only lost one of those games, right? You're talking about the Jets are 6-1. In their last 7 since that game against Pittsburgh. And we talked about that game. That was arguably one of the Jets' worst games of the year as far as the execution and the finish. And obviously, you know, the Penguins got a lot of luck there. There was a lot of bounces and everything like that. I didn't think that, you know, Connor Hellebuyck played particularly bad. I just thought the bounces went Pittsburgh's way. But when you're talking about 6 of 7 wins,
mm-hmm.
including one back-to-back, mean, this is a really important stretch for the Jets, and what they've done here is they've really separated themselves from the rest of the Central. I mean, Colorado, Dallas, Minnesota, they have no chance.
14 points behind the Winnipeg Jets
right
now.
It's basically the Jets and Nashville, and when you consider the Jets have the games in hand, they've started to separate themselves from Nashville.
Yeah. Well, and the crazy thing for me is, like, when I do my pregame reports for a little site called LegalCurve.com.
There's the first plug of the morning.
It's interesting to me, though, because, like, you know, I usually put the standings or where the Jets are positioned, obviously, against their competition, but, you know, relative to the rest of the Central. And when I was doing the one for Dallas today, I was like, I cannot believe they've already created a 14-point gap mm-hmm. between themselves and Colorado. That, to me, is significant. The gap between Nashville, I think, is obviously it's 4 points. They've got two games in hand. I don't know if it's going to stay that significant throughout. No. I think they'll probably be neck and neck for the run up to the playoffs. But I just, the separation they've managed to create mm-hmm. between themselves and third place, to me, is unbelievable.
And from my perspective, finishing first or second in the Central Division is relatively irrelevant because mm-hmm. we saw last year that home ice advantage in that second round series against the Predators, which we're all expecting to take place. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really mean anything. I mean, the road team won the majority of the games in the series last year. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that, I mean, obviously the Jets would rather be at home. They'd rather finish first as opposed to second in the Central, but I don't think it's a big difference. But I think it's a huge deal to not finish either third or in the wild card spot, clearly. Let me ask you guys this. So the win on Thursday against the Predators, it was a dominant effort. Was it just one win, or do you think that you could say that the Jets might be in the Predators' heads a bit?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I do think it's just one win. I don't think that this necessarily means that the Jets are going to the Stanley Cup final, but I think they are in the heads of the Predators because we knew that the Predators were that dragon that they were going to have to slay in order to get to the Western Conference final last year. And obviously, mm-hmm. you know, the Jets wanted to go further than that, but when you talk about specifically how the Jets have played in Nashville, right? Because Nashville has actually been very successful against the Jets during the regular season. Mm-hmm. And they obviously won 3-0 earlier this season, the game that featured 9 minor penalties. But, you know, the Predators know that their biggest obstacle this year, I think it's the opposite. It's the reverse, right? Because the Jets are playing better. The Jets are a better team right now. So the Predators know that they have to go through the Jets to get to the Western Conference final. And this Predators team is not going to be happy with just going to the second round. I mean, this is a team a couple years ago went to the Stanley Cup final. So, yeah, I do think that when you look at the Jets and what they've been able to do in the playoffs against Nashville, on the road especially, I mean, Nashville's a tough building to go into. Mm-hmm. I mean, you ask players around the league, Winnipeg is up there, but Nashville is also up there.
It's
not an easy building to win in.
No, I agree, Ez, and I think I'm of similar thinking to you. I think it's more of a one-off than anything. I mean, you could point to the Nashville game where they won 3-0, but I think that was obviously a lot earlier in the season. So it you say, okay, well, the teams are more where they should be, and they're kind of ramping up their game as we kind of get ready for that stretch drive. To me, I think what this does is it's going to create a bit of an arms race. I think if you're a GM who's looking to trade with either one of these two teams, I think you're seeing opportunity. I think if you're seeing a two-horse race and you see these guys are fairly evenly matched, maybe obviously giving the Jets a slight advantage, I mean, I think to any other GM, you're going to look and say, well, look, I've got this player X. I want to trade him. I'm going to make a phone call to both GMs, and I'm going to hear what their offers
are. Create a bidding war.
Absolutely. And if you're smart, you're going to be able to get quite a bit because they may want to keep a player. Look, we've seen this before, right? Where it's been rumored more last year, where there were guys who wanted to keep players away from going to the
Vegas
Jets.
Vegas with Derek Brassard and facilitating that third-party trade right. where he ended up in Pittsburgh.
Right. And now Pittsburgh might be looking to move Brassard, but
right.
I think Dave makes a lot of good points. And you have to remember, I mean, Kyle Turris wasn't in the lineup for Nashville, but no Dustin Byfuglien, mm-hmm. no Nikolaj Ehlers, and to a lesser extent, Ben Chiarot, even though Ben Chiarot's arguably having his best ever pro year. I mean, the Jets were missing some key pieces there. And
just the Predators.
They still beat Nashville 5-1. Now, back to your point, it's only one game.
Right.
But when you beat the Predators last year in an epic seven-game series, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's more than just one game.
Well, you know, it's funny because I look back at that seven-game series last year, and Scott Hartnell played a key role in that series in the victories for the
yep.
Predators. And the Preds don't have Scott Hartnell. He obviously retired.
Well, that's why you're hearing Wayne Simmons a lot, right?
Well, are the Predators, do they...
I think Wayne Simmons makes a lot of sense on that team.
Are they gritty enough? Are they physical enough? Because it looked like the Jets sort of beat him up a little bit. I mean, we saw Ryan Johansson with the two-handed tomahawk chop on Mark Scheifele.
Yeah.
You know, was the Jets' physicality maybe frustrating the Predators at times in that game on Thursday night?
Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, the Jets' physicality frustrates a lot of teams because the Jets are such a highly skilled team. but they can also beat you up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, the Brandon Tanev, Adam Lowry line, but, you know, you've got physical defensemen like Ben Chiarot when he's in the lineup, Dustin Byfuglien, but, you know, Brendan Lemieux has added a nice physical element to the game. Even Mason Appleton, Dave,
mm-hmm.
I don't think gets talked about. Mason Appleton's a big boy.
Yep.
And, you know, he's a skilled player. I mean, he's a goal scorer, playmaker, but he's a guy that can mix it up as well. So, I mean, the Jets are a hard team to play against when you factor in the size and the skill. So I think that when you're David Poile and you're looking at that game, you have to be thinking in the back of your mind, you know, what kind of moves are we going to make? And I don't know if it's going to be Wayne Simmonds, because I think Wayne Simmonds, as a pure rental,
makes a lot of sense.
And maybe you sign Wayne Simmonds, I'm not sure. But a player like that, that you could probably, you know, either
goal
play
scoring,
on your,
physicality,
right, second line or
the
third
whole
line.
Package.
But, I mean, they have Austin Watson, Colton Sissons. I mean, they've got physical players. So I don't necessarily know that I would say that Nashville is a light team, but you never know. I mean, it's the Tom Wilson effect. You're hearing that a lot around the NHL, that teams know how successful Tom Wilson was for Washington last year,
mm-hmm.
winning the Stanley Cup, and they say, you know, we want a Tom Wilson type of player.
Dave, last word, two games for Johansson for his chop on Scheifele. Appropriate, too harsh, not enough.
Well, it's the first time he's ever been disciplined by player safety in his NHL career, which spans 560 games, I think, or 561 games. He'd never been fined or suspended before. You know, I mean, it was definitely aggressive, and it could have resulted in a significant injury to Mark Scheifele. I think that's kind of the problem sometimes with these quick decisions. Like, I think you have to suspend the player pending to see, you know, I mean, you want to, if Mark Scheifele is going to be out a while, maybe it's a little more significant, but I mean, two games probably is where they were thinking, just simply based on the fact that he had no prior history.
Yeah, two games makes a lot of sense. And I think, Drew, you wonder if he got a 5-minute major on the play,
yeah.
would the suspension have been one game?
Sure, because right. they missed the call in mm-hmm. only assessing right. a 2-minute minor. When we come back, we talk about the Jets' new power play setup. Scheifele's in the line A spot. Line A's in the Scheifele spot. Is it working? Do you like it? That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Back it goes to Morrissey. Back to Wheeler. Wheeler scores! Blake Wheeler finds the short side with a power play tally, and that is a huge goal for the Winnipeg Jets.
It was a huge goal for the Jets. That was from last Sunday's victory over the Anaheim Ducks. That cut the Ducks' lead in half. The Jets, of course, ended up winning that contest. Congratulations to the Ducks, though. They ended their losing streak by beating the Minnesota Wild 3-0 earlier this week. So kudos to you, Anaheim.
And they're now in a wild card spot.
The rest of the Western Conference is pretty bad after you get through the top two teams in the Central and the top three teams in the Pacific.
How many teams in the Western Conference right now, Drew, have 49 points?
I think
three, and then you got Dallas at 50, Vancouver at 50.
Yeah, it's a pretty bad conference.
And Colorado's at 50.
Colorado's at 50, and they're third in the Central Division as a
result.
There's
five teams that are good in the West.
Yeah, there's five teams that are good in the West. That is definitely a true statement. And we'll talk more about the Metropolitan Division leading New York Islanders later on in the show, because I don't think anybody expected to say that at this point, this juncture in the season. Maybe after game two, you could have heard, you may have been able to hear that, but nobody expected it after game 49 and game 50.
I don't know. I think a couple weeks ago, I was pretty high on the New York Islanders.
We'll have to go back to the tape. There
we'll
is no
to go
tape.
Back to the tape. Except the tape has been destroyed.
The tape has been burned. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can reach us here in studio at Illegal Curve. Send us your comments if we like what we are seeing on Twitter. Maybe we'll even read it on air. This segment of the show brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center. Dr. Rikus and his team provide modern and comprehensive dental care for the whole family. To make an appointment today, visit lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Jets power play, since Dustin Byfuglien has been out of the lineup, not clicking. I mean, it's at 20%, which is 12th overall in the NHL.
At one point, they were first.
Well, this is just in the last nine games,
right.
They're 12th overall. So in that span of time without Byfuglien in the lineup. And obviously, to no one's surprise, the absence of Byfuglien is going to make a difference on the Jets power play. But what is surprising to me is the sort of shuffle of Mark Scheifele and Patrick Laine in terms of their position on the power play. We had been so used to seeing Laine in that sort of Ovechkin position and Scheifele in the middle, where he can either get the pass from Kyle Connor down at the goal line or Blake Wheeler on the half wall. But lately, what you're seeing is them switching. And I'm not sure that that's working as well as it should be or could be for the Winnipeg Jets.
Yeah, I agree. And I can see what Paul Maurice and the coaching staff is doing here. By the way, the Jets are still third overall in the NHL. But no, you're right. I mean, Dustin Byfuglien is a key part of that power play. And if you remember back to the first, you know, 2 or 3 years of the Jets, you know, we had the 3-forward, 2-defenseman power play, kind of the old school power play.
Mm-hmm.
Now teams like to go more with, you know, 4 forwards and a defenseman. Some teams still have 2 defensemen, but it's just not that typical setup that you used to see for so many years.
Was it Tuesday against Vegas? We saw 5 forwards on the power play.
Yep.
I mean, they were pressing to try and tie the game.
Right. And I would say that's more rare. Usually you have at least 1 defenseman out there, Drew. But I mean, Dustin Byfuglien, even though the power play is no longer just get it back to Big Buff for the big shot, I mean, that's what it used to be, right? I mean, the Jets had other weapons. But now the power play clearly runs through Blake Wheeler trying to get the puck to either Mark Scheifele, Patrick Laine, or Kyle Connor, right? And so when you look at the power play without Dustin Byfuglien, I mean, you've seen Jacob Trouba basically take over his spot. And I've talked to Dave about this quite a bit since Buff has been out. I actually prefer Josh Morrissey out there on the first power play unit. But the point is, I think now without Dustin Byfuglien out there, teams have less respect for Jacob Trouba's shot. I mean, it's clearly evident if you've watched the Jets' power play. I mean, if Dustin Byfuglien is out there, you have to respect that shot because it's hard and it's accurate. Plus, you know that he's a good puck distributor, so he has that ability. And I'm not saying that Jacob Trouba is not a good power play defenseman. I'm just saying Byfuglien is more effective and he's more dangerous. But back to what you were talking about before, Drew, with switching Laine and Scheifele.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, clearly we're used to seeing Laine there in his wheelhouse on the left side, you know, that Alex Ovechkin spot that he's been so dangerous scoring from there. And I can see what they're doing by trying to move in and trying to give teams other looks. Now, you have to ask yourself, is this the most effective use of one of the best goal scorers in the league? And I agree with you. I think at times, you know, Patrick Laine looks a little bit lost in the middle because he's used to playing that spot on the half boards, kind of around the face-off circle there, and,
mm-hmm.
getting the passes from whoever it is, whether it's, you know, a Blake Wheeler or the defenseman. Right now it's Jacob Trouba, but you know, I don't think they're necessarily going to stick with this. Now, what I would prefer to see is a little movement where you see Patrick Laine at times, based on what type of penalty kill you're seeing, Dave. Maybe you see then Patrick Laine and Mark Scheifele switch. Mark Scheifele's got a great shot too, an underrated shot. But I think you ideally want to open up Patrick Laine into shooting situations, right? You want him to create space for himself, but you also want your other players on the power play to create space. And that's probably best done with him on that left side, you know, by the faceoff circle there. So I don't think Laine has been particularly effective in the middle, and I wouldn't expect the Jets to stick with it, quite frankly.
You know, not to pick on Laine, because Scheifele hasn't been effective since the switch either. Scheifele hasn't been effective in the Laine spot. Laine hasn't been effective in the Scheifele spot. So the whole switch to me, trying things is never wrong, but at some point in time, it's perplexing that they continue to experiment with this when it clearly, to my perspective, it hasn't worked well since they've started it.
No, but I mean, I think you just said the key point, Drew. I think the whole idea is when you're the Jets, and we've talked about it in the last segment, but when you've built this kind of lead and your power play is as lethal as it is, guess what? It's not a bad idea to try these things. And we talked about what depth does for you. I mean, the reality is you don't know who you're going to have. You don't know if you become too reliant on something, mm-hmm. and then one of those pieces changes, and perhaps it changes a day before the playoffs. Well, guess what? You're going to be very happy that you couldn't go back and have a little muscle memory to be able to say, oh, Patrick Laine worked in this position, or Mark Scheifele worked in this position, or Blake Wheeler worked in this position. So I think from the Jets' perspective, now is the time that you want to be testing out these theories. You want to be ramping this stuff up and saying like, okay, well, we know we have an extremely effective power play in this configuration. What happens when we change it to this? Now, if they keep this for the remainder of the season, then I suspect you're probably right, and it doesn't work, then that point would be more concerning. But I think from my perspective, right now, you have the luxury of the situation to be able to put yourself into to say, okay, well, let's try some things out here.
And Dave, I think part of it, what you've heard is Mark Scheifele is a right shot, and so is Patrick Laine. Kyle Connor is a left shot, and Kyle Connor likes to feed Mark Scheifele in the middle there. So as far as the Jets coaching staff is concerned, you're kind of replacing one dangerous sniper with another dangerous sniper who isn't having success there on the left side. So you're trying to, you know, kind of catch lightning in a bottle there with that kind of center spot, because the Jets have so many different weapons that it's not just going to be that big shot from you know, the left half boards. It's possibly going to be coming from the point, or it's going to be coming from the middle, whether Scheifele's there or Laine's there. So I think Paul Maurice has no problem putting Laine there because he knows that guys like Blake Wheeler and Kyle Connor can get him the puck. Now, is he scoring at the same rate on the power play as he used to be? No, but I really do think the goals are going to come. I realize a lot of fans are frustrated because they're used to Laine scoring on the power play almost every game. Like in November, Laine was literally scoring on the power play every single game. every single game, he'd get at least one.
You were surprised when the power play didn't succeed in November.
So
you're
in a slump of, you know, let's call it 20 games or so on the power play.
I mean, Laine's got 0 points in since Dustin Byfuglien has left, has been injured on the Jets' power play. Scheifele only has 2 points since Byfuglien was injured on the Jets' power play, just in power play situations. So, I mean, I guess what maybe this move has done is it's allowed Blake Wheeler to become more of the trigger man because the defenses are playing off of him because they have to respect the pass to Scheifele or the pass to Laine. And Wheeler has been able to take advantage with some, you know, by shooting, which you heard in that clip where he played the goal against Anaheim. That was the Jets' last power play goal, to be honest, which was so they went, you know, they've gone a number of games without scoring on the power play. To me, it's just, you know, and I guess to your point, Dave, it makes sense that you try things right now because you never know when you might have to implement them unexpectedly. To me, though, at some point in time, I would expect to see Laine go back to where he's been most successful and where and Scheifele go back to where he's been most successful.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. I think also that if you remember, before they made the move, Laine wasn't, as we talked about, wasn't having that success. And there were a lot of passes that when we would normally be sitting there in the press box watching, looking down and thinking, okay, well, I'd lean over to Ez and I'd say, like, that's going to be a goal because you'd see it setting up.
Yeah.
And you'd see the perfect pass from Wheeler. And they were jumping over Laine's stick and hopping, or he wasn't quite corralling the puck the way he normally does. So I think it was just more a function of, you know, coaching staffs like to break things up sometimes if they're not having the same level of success that we're used to. So I think that's simply, it was just symptomatic of that. Move him over, see if they can get a little chemistry doing that. And to your point, Drew, clearly it's not working. Maybe you try one or two more games of it. Maybe you don't. Maybe you go back to the old configuration. But I suspect what will happen is for the remainder of like tonight's game, then they have the player break and all-star break.
And so Dustin Byfuglien's supposed to be back or could very well be back right after that player
break. So my
break.
Suspicion would be that you'd leave it for tonight and then you'd probably go back to the way it was when Byfuglien's back.
When we return, we head out to Dallas. Paul Edmonds, Winnipeg Jets broadcaster, is going to join us to tee up tonight's contest against the Stars and for more Jets talk. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. That's the best way to reach us here in studio. And our website has got the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We head out to Dallas, Texas, where the Jets and the Stars are going to do battle a little bit later on tonight. We're joined now by the voice of the Winnipeg Jets here on TSN 1290, our good buddy Paul Edmonds. Paulie, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. My pleasure, guys. One day to go and then a bit of a break. We'll see what happens here tonight, but I would have to tell you, I think the Winnipeg Jets are pretty focused to get this done in a positive manner this evening.
Sure, they'd want to start the player break on a good note, certainly, and they have that opportunity to do so tonight against the Stars, Paulie. Before we look to tonight's contest, I want to take you back to Thursday night in Nashville, where the Jets had one of their most complete efforts of the season with that 5-1 victory. And I asked Dave and Ezzy this question when we began the program about 30 or so minutes ago. Was it just one win on Thursday night, or do you think that it was more of a statement than just a W in the win column?
Well, I think, you know, in honesty, when you look at it, guys, in all honesty, it was a statement for sure. But it also goes back to they weren't very happy with the way they played there in October, and they ended up losing 3-0, one of three games where they've been shut out this year, twice in the road, so there was that. It was also the fact that they didn't feel that they were very good in that game from the outset, and that was an arena where they dominated last year in the playoffs, quite frankly. You know, and also I think that when you're looking at Nashville and they had been sort of the top team in the division for the last few years, or one of them, it was a statement from the standpoint that maybe there's a new gunslinger in town, and the Winnipeg Jets certainly made that clear with the way that they played. And then I think also that they kind of felt that maybe even though they were getting some people back from injury, that Nashville was a little bit wounded, and they wanted to take advantage of that. So there's two more games left between the two teams. Both of them will happen in Winnipeg. So you've got that advantage after splitting the first two games, certainly in Nashville. And then the other part of it is, too, going into the break, Winnipeg Jets will go into the break because of that victory in first place in the division. So there was a lot of things at play here, including, as we've talked about, and I really believe it was a statement game for the Winnipeg Jets, and the way they played in the game as well. They had a game where a goal came back on the game. They rallied around that, certainly didn't falter in the last 2 minutes, where things can really get off the rails in that building like no other building in the matter of 2 or 3 minutes. They got through that. They ended up getting some key efforts, I think, from some lesser light players in the fourth line and that third set of defense. And then I thought Connor Hellebuck, in all honesty, guys, had his best game of the year. So, yeah, it was a statement for a lot of reasons, some of which I just mentioned. But it was an important win for the Winnipeg Jets as they get through the doldrums of the mid-season here, you know, the sort of dog days of winter, if you will, before they get to the break. But also very important because they showed me something, and that was they kept the focal point in on a couple of games so far in Vegas, Nashville, and maybe tonight before they get to that break. And I know this break's on everybody's mind, but before they got there, they certainly had a little bit of business to take care of, and they've done so far, 2 for 2 in a couple of important games along the way.
Paulie, sticking with the big win in Nashville on Thursday night, you just mentioned the Jets' fourth line, and we have to talk about number 48. Brendan Lemieux scores the Jets' first goal, and he scores the fifth goal of the game. And to you, is this just a player that's taking advantage of the more ice time that he's being given?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we're also starting to see any of that criticism on Brendan Lemieux that he wasn't going to be able to skate at this level. He certainly had a element to his game that the Winnipeg Jets didn't have a lot, and that's probably one of the reasons that he would get a further look or be advanced on the depth chart over somebody else, but that his skating ability wasn't quite on par with where it needed to be. While we've certainly seen that that isn't true, he can skate and he can play the game, and he is certainly, I think, everybody right across the board will always do better with more minutes. I mean, look at the injuries to Tyler Myers and to Dustin Byfuglien and what some of the guys in Jacob Truba, Ben Sherrod, and Dmitry Kulikov have done in the same vein, guys. You know, and now Myers is back. But, I mean, in the absence of a pretty big minute muncher in Dustin Byfuglien, you've seen Jacob Truba and Tyler Myers really elevate their game, and Dmitry Kulikov as well. So I think any time that you're playing a little bit more, there's a little bit more confidence. I think the one thing that it does for you in terms of the confidence department is if you go out and you make a mistake, you know you're not going to be sitting there for the next 8 or 9 minutes sitting on that shift waiting for your next shift. Chances are, because you're getting into more of a rotation, that you make that mistake, you get right back out there and you get an opportunity not to dwell on that shift for maybe half a period, three quarters of a period. So I think that players certainly benefit from that as well. And just a little bit more comfort in the NHL game for Brendan Lemieux. I think he's always sort of had the stones when it comes to his bravado about being an NHLer, but he had to prove it, certainly. But the minutes that he's getting now in that fourth line, and I also believe, Ezra, that the addition of putting Andrew Kopp has settled everything down there a bit too. I mean, he's a five-year veteran. He's played in around that bottom six for quite a few years. He knows what he's doing. He's a face-off guy that can start with the puck. And as a result, I think Mason Appleton and Brendan Lemieux have really started to thrive with him in the middle. But Brendan's two goals were huge. I really like the first one, the way he kind of drove the net, realized there wasn't a play towards the middle, curled around in the wraparound. And I don't know if you saw it on TV. The funniest part was, there was a minute 20 left in the hockey game. The Jets are up 5-1. They didn't want to pull the goalie, Nashville, because the game was not in question at that point. But the Jets wanted to give Brendan Lemieux an opportunity for the hat trick. So they sent him out there, and he was out there for about a minute and 20 seconds. He was dog-tired. With about 20 seconds left in the hockey game, he left the attacking zone to come over to the Winnipeg Jets bench for a line change. And they all waved him back out there. Get back out there. Let's see if you can take one last shot to get the hat trick. And his tongue was hanging out by his shin pad. So it was kind of funny. But that's the kind of thing you start to see, those little intricacies of what's going on with this team, that they've come together and the chemistry is there. And listen, Brendan Lemieux had a huge impact in that game. And I think the guys were really happy for him. He did. Really happy that the fourth line contributed the way they did. But more minutes means more confidence, and you're only as great as your weakest. And certainly if your fourth line is contributing like they did the other night, pretty strong hockey team.
You know, Paul, we talk about statement games, and you know, Vegas obviously was an important game, and Nashville was an important game, and there was some thought originally and some surprise when Laurent Brossoit got the start against Vegas, and you know, he talked a little bit about how he's coming to the season with a chip on his shoulder, and it was almost as if Connor Hellebuyck had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, not necessarily outwardly, but the way in way he played, the statement game he had to have in Nashville, and I thought he had it for the Winnipeg Jets. Just how important do you think that game was for Connor Hellebuyck?
Well, in a lot of respects, I think we got back to a little bit of what we saw early on last year when Connor took the ball and kind of ran with it, guys. Like, he wasn't expected really to be the number one guy. And as a result, you bring in Steve Mason and he's going to get the opportunity at the start of the season. Well, as we know, he faltered, but it put a little bit of pressure certainly on Connor Hellebuyck, and he grabbed it and he ran. And I think that Connor, even though he and Laurent Brossoit are good friends and they get along very well, you start to feel that maybe your number one celebrity is in a little bit of jeopardy here. So you better go back out and prove yourself. And while he was a little cheeky with the media leading up when they left Nashville on Wednesday, sort of answering or asking some questions within his answer on the questions coming from the media, sort of joking, but you could tell there was an undercurrent to him not being very happy with the line of questioning. I thought he went out and proved it the other day. And simply, it's not that he's out there doing pad stacks and diving around and being all flashy. It's just simply square to the puck, right position, rebound control for Connor Hellebuyck. The times he comes out and handles the puck behind the net, just do it cleanly and get back in the net and make sure you make the save. And he certainly did that. There was a couple of times where they had some grade-A scoring chances on him. There was a breakaway there. He stopped that, kicked that aside on Arvidsson, even though the horn goes off. You know, I mean, that was crazy, too. It was a lot of things went on in that game. But I thought clearly that Connor Hellebuyck, as I said earlier in the interview, guys, that he had his best game of the season. And it was for a number of reasons. And whether he put some self-pressure on himself to perform a little bit better or it's just the way it went down, I'm not sure, maybe a little bit of both. But he benefited, and so did the Winnipeg Jets from that. And maybe now we'll see Connor Hellebuyck be a little bit more consistent, because I don't think that we could be critical of Connor Hellebuyck for the way he's played this year, because it's been pretty decent. The numbers are there. But I think that there's been a few games earlier on this year where there might have been a softie or two, and therefore the lack of consistency label comes in there at times. But I think overall, Connor's been very good. The one thing is, I mean, you can look at some of the numbers comparatively speaking to last year, and he's had 12 shutouts over his career, and six of them last year, and nary a shutout this year. So somebody might point to that, but I thought that the other night was as good as throwing up a zero when you turn aside as many shots in the volume that he had. And the only goal that he gets beat on was Arvidsson at the side of the net, which he has no chance on. So, you know, David, I thought that he had a real good game. And maybe as we're talking about statement games for the Winnipeg Jets, the goaltender made a bit of a statement that he's not ready to be superseded by anybody in the National Hockey League, especially on his team when it comes to the way he's playing and the fact that he was a Vezina candidate last year.
Paul Edmonds is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He joins us from Dallas, where the Jets and the Stars will do battle a little later tonight, a game you can, of course, hear live on TSN 1290. Paulie, it hasn't translated necessarily on the scoreboard into goals. He had an assist on Thursday night. But to me, Jack Roslovic looks like a player who's playing with more confidence, and he's maybe the game, the NHL game, has slowed down for him as of late. Do you see Jack Roslovic maybe taking that next step, you know, sort of halfway through his first lengthy stint in the NHL?
I do, and I think all you have to do is look at the number of games that have been played by Jack Roslovic over his short career. I mean, he's not even at 82, which would represent the season. Tonight, it'll be game number 79. We're starting to see this. You know, it's 82 games, and you know, usually around that 100-game mark, you start to analyze forwards a little bit more. It takes a little bit more for defensemen, a little bit more for goaltenders, for sure. But he's also benefited, I think, from playing in the middle and Brian Little. And Brian's value to this team, I don't know that you can measure it right now because, yeah, he's found the score sheet a little bit of late, which is great for Brian and his psyche because he's considered to be a second-line center. But he's really had to take some young guys under his wing over the last couple of years, whether it be Ehlers or Line A and Al Connor for a little bit. And Jack Roslovic falls right underneath that fold. And I just think to take the pressure away from Jack on that defensive game to play in the middle, put him over onto the wing, takes a little bit of that pressure and some of the reads away, and you can just play a little bit more of a straight line game and get back to scheme and stick handling. And that's what I think we're seeing from Jack Roslovic. Listen, he's got skill to burn here, the speed, the ability to make moves east-west and continue to go and push north while he has the puck. Maybe a little bit more finish would be nice, or the ability to make those moves and then squeeze off a shot, I think, is the next sort of step for him to come and certainly improve on. But I think that that's one of those areas where the more that he plays like we're talking about the last few games, that we'll start to see that kind of creep into his game on a positive side as well. So very beneficial for the Winnipeg Jets and Jack Roslovic. There's no doubt in my mind that at some point, Jack will be centerman for the Winnipeg Jets. But for right now, the way things shake down on the depth chart, he's kind of better served on that wing right now, and he's getting quite a bit of time, and it kind of falls back into that category that we talked about with Brendan Lemieux. A little bit more ice time and the ability to play a little bit more comes the confidence and the belief system that you can play and succeed and have a lot of success at this level. So we'll see what happens here tonight, but I like Jack Roslovic's game of late as well. He's kind of pushing the pace. He's hard on the puck. He's not afraid of the physical stuff. He could certainly go into the corner on a one-on-one 50-50 battle and win it most times, which is what you want, which is great for a guy like Patrick Laine, who was another guy who I thought had a great game the other night against Nashville, even though he only hit the score sheet with one assist. But overall, I think you're probably seeing the best of the Winnipeg Jets. Certainly the young guys are kind of driving a little bit of that as well right now.
Paulie, last question for you here. Mason Appleton is another rookie forward for the Jets who just seems to be getting better and better. And during the first segment, I mentioned that I thought that Appleton's goal was maybe, you know, the key goal in that game against Nashville. He beats Ryan Johansson to the front of the net, gets a really nice pass from Joe Morrow. But how hard is that decision going to be for Paul Maurice and the coaching staff once Nikolai Ehlers comes back? Where does Mason Appleton fit in? Because he's really looked good on that fourth line.
You know, it's kind of funny, too. I mean, when you look at the depth chart on that, the guy that's had more experience is Nick Patan, and he's the guy that's pulling press box duty, right? So you could probably say that Mason Appleton in a short period of time, Ezra, has beaten out Nick Patan on the depth chart as well. So that's a really good question about Nikolai Ehlers and when he comes back and certainly what happens. And I think a lot of it will depend on the type of game and the type of team that they're playing. If they feel that it's going to be a bit of a game, then probably Brendan Lemieux is going to be the guy that factors in. And if they feel that it's not going to be that, then you probably will have Mason Appleton kind of stay in into the contest, and Brendan Lemieux is the guy that comes out. So that would be my guess, right? Because somebody's going to have to factor out, and you're always looking at your fourth line or your bottom three or bottom four as you move some people around. But I think Mason has certainly acquitted himself well enough to remain a National Hockey League player. You know, he's a bit of a late bloomer. Just look at his age. You know, he's into his mid-20s here. It's not like he's 21 years old, but he's had to battle all the way through his entire career to get to this level and probably feels that it's a little bit more rewarding. He understands how hard it is to work to maintain, you know, his NHL status. It's the old question, like, was it harder getting to the NHL or staying there? And he probably would say a little bit of both. I'll let you know in 10 years when my career is done, right? So, you know, he's been another real good fit for the Winnipeg Jets. Straight line guy, skates real well, has some skill. And you're right, Ezra, that backdoor goal was beautiful. And it was a bit of a backbreaker in that hockey game on Thursday night. For that victory for the Winnipeg Jets, for sure.
Paul Edmonds will be part of the broadcast crew tonight when the Jets and the Stars do battle in Dallas to wrap up the pre-player break portion of the schedule. Paulie, thanks for joining us this morning. Have a great call tonight with Munsey and with Dennis.
Thanks very much, guys. My pleasure. Have a great weekend.
You too, Paul. Thanks a lot, bud. When we come back, Jack Roslovic, is he getting more comfortable? Does he look like the game is beginning to slow down for him? We talk about Roslovic up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN 1290.ca.
You know, I don't know how long, you know, Nikki's going to be out for, so, you know, I'm going to try to stay here as long as I can and, you know, try to make the most of it, you know, try to help the line out and you know, bring my speed to the game and try to make something happen.
Earlier this week, Jack Roslovic, it might have been actually a couple weeks ago now that I think about it, Jack Roslovic addressing the media in his new second-line role alongside Patrick Laine and Brian Little. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we're live on TSN Radio 1290. And this segment is brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. Jack Roslovic, it hasn't translated into points, but Tuesday night against Vegas, I thought he was one of the Jets' most dangerous forwards. I thought he was very noticeable on Thursday night against the Nashville Predators as well, where he registered an assist.
Yeah, he made a nice play there, Drew, and I know you were going to get into that before I rudely interrupted you.
That's true.
You know, he keeps the puck in the Predators' zone, and, you know, Patrick Laine puts the puck on a really hard shot, by the way. You can see Pekka had a lot of trouble with that shot, and then Brian Little, as he's done so many times, you know, deposits the rebound. But yeah. I agree with you. And that goes back to what we've been talking about really all year. When Jack Roslovic is playing on the fourth line and he's only getting 4 or 5 minutes of ice time, how effective can he be, right?
Right. So lately, of course, since he got the promotion with Nikolaj Ehlers being injured, you know, Roslovic's time has been in and around the 13-14-minute mark where he's playing a regular second-line role. And he just seems to me to be more comfortable. He had a couple of rushes on Tuesday and Thursday that were just – they looked dangerous. And they didn't necessarily result in anything. And there was at least two or three on Tuesday in particular where he carries the puck, he gets zone entry, he gets the puck in deep, he maintaining control the whole time, and I think he had one where his stick, they sort of just fluttered off his stick.
Yeah, the puck popped off his stick about 2 or 3 times.
That's right,
yeah.
But this is a guy who's now becoming more noticeable, and I think he's maybe blossoming into the offensive, he's got the potential to blossom into that offensive force the Jets expected when he was drafted in the first round, and it's always interesting to see a player sort of get his feet underneath him, because the game when you first break into the NHL and you first get regular ice time is a million miles an hour. But now it seems like it's slowing down and he's becoming more comfortable in his role with the Winnipeg Jets.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, he had 83 points in 97 games in the AHL with the Manitoba Moose, and by last season in October, in November, he was dominating, and that team was just simply dominant throughout the AHL. I would say they were the best team in the AHL in October, November, for a variety of reasons, and into December. And then obviously he got the call up at the end of December, and he hasn't looked back since.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we talk about the fact that it's opportunity, and as you just touched on it, about minutes played and how many minutes he's getting, and slowly but surely getting, you know, thrown into different roles. And you see people saying he should be the second line center ahead of Brian Little, and like, you know, and I get it. I understand people get frustrated and they say if the Jets aren't having success, they just want to, you know, it's always like it's same thing similar to Connor Hellebuyck, right? You see Laurent Brossoit having such good success. Well, now suddenly he's the guy who you want in the net, not Connor Hellebuyck. Yeah. Similar to that. You know,
Brian, quarterback's always the most popular player.
Yeah, and Huss had a really funny tweet about how, like, in the summer it was the backup quarterback everybody's enamored with, and now in the winter everybody's enamored with the backup goalie. But I just think
shout out to Sammy Garza.
So I just think it's a function of, you know, trusting. You know, and we hear this a lot from the coaching staff, but I think it's true. It's trusting the process. And part of that process is allowing these guys to develop in the roles that they're going to be comfortable with, not giving them too much responsibility. And sometimes that means only a 6 or 7 or 8 minute game on the ice because of circumstance. But you know what? That's part of learning your role in the NHL. And as you gain games, you know, under your belt, and now he has 78 NHL games under his belt, mm-hmm. as you touched on, Drew, I just think he's becoming more and more comfortable. And you're seeing that on the ice. And I think that's what you're talking about. That's that translation of, okay, I'm understanding the game. And now as I slowly but surely get more responsibility, i.e. playing on the second line, mm-hmm. well, then you're going to see him take that responsibility. And he's always been a fairly defensively responsible player anyways, which is, you know, what we see and what you've come to really appreciate in Brian Little's game is how responsible he is. And, of course, now he's adding – I think he's on a 7-game point streak right now. So
9 points in his last 7 games
right.
since Nikolaj Ehlers was injured in Pittsburgh. That's where Brian Little has put up.
Right. So Brian Little is always been defensively responsible, but now he's obviously contributing on the offensive side as well. And I think from fans' perspective, they're seeing what Jack Roslovic is capable of. I mean, again, like I said, he was almost a point-of-game player in the AHL. I'm not suggesting he's going to be a point-of-game player in the NHL, of course, because it doesn't translate that easily always. But
one day he might be.
Yeah, he may, but I just think like
it's not imminent.
It's just a function of development. And yeah. I think, you know, we talk about this all the time, and I say to people, like, you know, with Sammy Niku, for example, or anyone who's within the AHL system, it's not a bad thing to develop in that league. Similarly, sometimes it's not a bad thing to have guys develop at a slower place in the NHL. Now, again, the NHL is in a developmental league, but there's a learning curve, obviously, and you touched on it, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
There's that learning curve that you have to gain through actual playing the game. So, again, he's gone through that learning curve, I think, and to Paul's point about almost at that full season mark, we're going to probably see him kind of really start to incline because he's such a smart player.
Well, you know, you never want to see a player get injured, but Ehlers obviously being out of the Jets lineup has, you know, opened up this opportunity for Roslovic and opened up the more minutes that he's playing. And now when Ehlers comes back, again, you know, Paul Maurice will have the comfort level in knowing that Jack Roslovic is a guy that can play, you know, the 14 minutes a game, the 15 minutes a game, and maybe it's not on necessarily on the second line role when Ehlers comes back, but he can play on a third line role or whatever the lines end up being.
Well,
Roslovic is a guy who has played and has logged the more minutes than he had been playing when Ehlers was in the lineup.
Well, it's a good point that you make, Drew, because I think everyone just kind of expects Jack Roslovic to go back to the fourth line because Matty Perreault has found a home there on the third line with Adam Lowry and Brandon Tanev, but, you know, maybe you add a bit of an offensive twist to that third line. I mean, mm-hmm. we know it's a check-in line, and Jack Roslovic's strength is not his forechecking and his defensive play. I'm not saying that he's not good at it, but he's an offensive-minded player. He's a playmaker.
Mm-hmm.
He can score, but he also likes to set up plays, and, you know, I agree with Dave when he says that his offensive game is blossoming, and, you know, when you go from 4.5 minutes, 6 minutes to, you know, 13 minutes, as you mentioned, Drew, and he starts to get more responsibility on the second line. I mean, you're starting to really see that NHL game come together for him because the game in the NHL is much different. I mean, that doesn't come from experience playing in the NHL, but it comes from knowing that the skill level is just that much higher. Dave mentioned it, almost a point per game in the American Hockey League. Roslovic had nothing more to prove in the American Hockey League. He was one of the best players there, and now when he's been given a chance, he's taken the most of it. Sure, you'd like to see maybe some more points, but that's not what it's all about. I mean, the future is very bright, and, you know, to the point about being the second-line center, I mean, that's a couple of years down the road. Right now, you've got Mark Scheifele and Brian Little as your top two centers. Don't get too excited here. Roslovic's future is very bright, and you're starting to see his game really come together, I think, here.
When we come back, we're going to be joined by Daniel Carcillo. He's certainly outspoken and passionate about the issues of concussion in the NHL and the treatment of players in their post-NHL career. Daniel Carcillo will join us next. It should be an interesting interview. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. The podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN Radio 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and Dave Minuk. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome to the program Daniel Carcillo. You, of course, remember Daniel from his NHL career, and he's now an outspoken advocate for the health of players in the NHL and players who have been retired from the NHL. Daniel, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Morning, guys. Appreciate you guys having me on.
And we appreciate you joining us, Daniel. You know, as fans of the game or people who follow the game, you sort of become a little bit depersonalized and dehumanized, the players do, when it comes to the actual effect that the game has on them, physically, mentally. Right now, January 19th, can you sort of walk us through your health, both your physical health and your mental health, as a result of having played so many games in the NHL?
Yeah, of course. When I left the game, I'll just give you the laundry list, because what you need to do, what I tell guys at Chapter 5, the NHLPA health insurance will always try to deny your treatments because they'll date it back to hockey-related injuries, so you got to be really careful with verbiage. So what I did was I went to get x-rays, MRIs done on my whole body, and what I found out was that I left the game with two horizontal tears on my ankles, arthritis in my ankles, I have no PCL on my right knee. I've had my MCL done 5 times on my right knee. I've had an ACL reconstructive surgery on my left knee. I've had my MCL done 4 times on my left knee. I have an inch of arthritis in both knees. I've had my labrum done on my left hip. I've had my abdomen stapled back to my pelvis on my left side. Those two surgeries happened 14 days apart in Philadelphia. I have no left labrum in my left shoulder. I have arthritis in my hips. I have arthritis in my shoulders. I have arthritis in 3 of my discs in my neck. I have numerous neck tears, and I've had 7 diagnosed concussions. So that's what the game does to a human being, which I'm well prepared to deal with the arthritis, to deal with, you know, the dentists and the 3 lost teeth and the broken nose and the broken jaw. But what almost killed me were the mental health complications brought on by repetitive head trauma, and the league just does not educate. And then what I found out about 1.5 years ago is that they actually withheld the information from us, and that's where my issue lies.
Daniel Carcillo is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You mentioned the league and withholding the evidence from you. You know, and you also mentioned the NHLPA and how the NHLPA will deny everything insurance-wise and say it's a pre-existing condition. You know, who's the NHLPA advocating for? Are they doing a good enough job advocating for the current players and the past players, or are they maybe falling down on the job?
So it's the old boys club that's running it. I'll just pose a question to people. Number one, to answer yours, I don't know who they serve. Actually, I do know who they serve. They serve the PR machine, right? They're more community relations rather than actually being a union and protecting the players. The first 3 letters in the NHLPA are NHL, so you can't really trust them right away. And take it a step further. They try to basically control a narrative. And what I don't like about the NHLPA is that I started my own foundation. They called me into the office, into the lawyer's office, and they said they basically wanted to find out what's going on with me as far as what I was up to. It wasn't to trade information. It wasn't to trade information to try and help guys to create, you know, a better transition program. It was basically just to find out what I was doing and then try to, you know, keep a muzzle on me, so to speak. I don't know why Donald Fair makes $3 million when the NHL is now in 5th place in generating sport-related revenue. And he makes $3 million, and the NFLPA union leader makes 1.2. I don't know why Matthew Schneider's making $1 million when the other assistant executive directors of the PA for the NFL are making around $300,000. So the NHLPA is going to be exposed as well in all of this, right? The first thing for me is to make sure that guys understand the risks and get proper diagnosis and care for the head trauma stuff. But a bunch of players, current and former, have actually asked for a business review of the NHLPA because the NHL teams have underreported funds by the tune of about $3 million each team over the course of, I think it's been 25 years that they dated it back. And all of that stuff is going to come out. You know, guys want to see where their money's being spent, right? Where the union dues are going. Why are they staying at the Peninsula when it's $800 a night hotels? You know, it's just, it's not right. And these guys have a cush life. And to be honest with you, you need to get guys in place that will fight for current players, okay? And in my opinion, Matthew Schneider's not the guy, you know? And neither is Steve Webb, and neither is Rob Zamener, you know? And so they're going to have a lot of questions to answer to coming up here.
You know, Dan, speaking of fighting, you've said on record that that's what you're doing. You're fighting for ex-players. And Nick Boynton, who last year did some Jets games, former NHL defenseman, of course, you guys have both said that you're not going to agree to this NHL concussion settlement. Just for those who aren't familiar with the concussion settlement, why are you so opposed to the concussion settlement, and where would you like to see it go from here?
All right, well, first of all, the number figure cost me, since 2015, I've spent almost $160,000 on care just to get my quality of life back. So $22,000 isn't going to do anything for anybody. Number two, you look at the testing procedure and protocol. It's $22,000, then you're eligible for $75,000 if the NHL-appointed neuropsychologist finds two regions of your brain that are shut down. He has to identify at least two regions of your brain that are shut down for you to be eligible for $75,000. So, and then take it a step further, those testing procedures and the MRIs and seeing the neuropsychologist, you pay for that out of the $22,000, okay? And then take it a step further, like I mentioned, the NHL controls the results of the test, all right? And they do that because they don't want you going to the media with your results and showing them how hurt you are so they can control the narrative that they give to parents and kids. There's a ton of red flags. And I know this because I've been speaking to lawyers. I've been taking paralegal classes, and I'm digging in because this matters to me. And this killed my best friend, Steve Monitor, I won't let it kill anybody else. There's other guys that are still my friends in the league that are currently out right now with concussions. Two former Blackhawks. You probably know who they are. One current and one former. And they're both out with concussions.
You know, Daniel.
And they're suffering. So I do this for those guys. And to the other point, as you intro'd me, I'm using the NHL as a platform, okay? I want everybody to understand this. I'm going to use them the same way they used a bunch of guys, okay? But this is going to get to the veteran community, to police officers, to firefighters, to first responders. I'm really not that concerned about changing the game. What I do love doing, it's a kind of a hobby of mine, is holding people accountable. Hopefully that happens and certain people in certain positions get exposed for who they truly are.
You know, Daniel, I guess I have a two-part question. First part would be, have you talked to a lot of former players, and how do they feel about your outspokenness on this? And secondly, what sort of impact, maybe not necessarily on the guys currently in the NHL, but on young players who want to make the NHL, are you hoping to have?
I just want them to have the proper understanding of the risks of playing hockey, playing a collision sport. And if you understand that risk, if you have all of the information and then you want to sign on the dotted line for a monetized value, that's on you. But if you don't understand the risks and you're actually not given the risks, that's where the problem lies. Okay? The NHLPA took the word dementia off of these fake posters that they said they had. There weren't any posters there might be now, but there weren't any posters. They said they implemented it in 2012 in every single away room. There's no posters. There's no posters. They're lying. What was the first part of your question?
Just have you spoken to any former players, and how do they feel about your level of kind of outspokenness?
They love it. They're not going to bite the hand that feeds and support me publicly, but they love it. I've sent probably over 30 guys to the Plasticity Brain Center. And you know what they text me back? Their wife texts me crying, calling my wife, thank you so much for giving me my husband back. The guys text me, holy man, how do people not know about this? I can't wait to go back home and try out my new body. That's what they say. This isn't about not playing hockey. This is just about understanding the risks and giving these athletes that are amazing athletes today the proper diagnosis and care so that it works three ways, okay? The human being, number one, is most important, okay? People aren't serving the sport anymore. It's not sports medicine. It's athlete medicine. So you serve the athlete so that guys don't leave the game with a chemical imbalance and mental health complications like suicidal ideation that they don't understand, all right? Number two, the fans win because you'll see an optimized athlete. Hand-eye coordination, processing speed, very important for hockey players. That'll increase with this type of treatment. Number three, less man gains loss for the owners and the GMs. What's the problem? Everybody wins.
Daniel Carcillo is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Daniel, you mentioned the brain center that you've sent a number of your former colleagues and your former players to. What happens at this brain center that isn't happening really outside of this facility?
They diagnose five systems, and they check five different systems for concussion. Your autonomic system, your vestibular system, your ocular system, your affect system, and your cognitive system. All right. And then step six is to make you a personalized program accordingly, because I'm sure you've heard it before. Each concussion is like a snowflake, and it is, because it's very unique. And it's unique because of genetics and biomarkers and a whole bunch of reasons. What they do is they identify the areas of your brain that are hurt. A concussion is not a concussion on your whole brain. It's a common misconception. There are six different areas of our brain, so they diagnose through the eyes which areas are actually shut down. And for a lot of us, it's our frontal lobes. That's where we hold anxiety, depression, okay? And for me, I was right brain injured. You're not right and left brain injured. You're either left brain or you're right brain. For me, I was right brain injured. They identified my frontal lobe, my right frontal lobe, and my lower right cortex. And so what they do through the diagnostic process is identify that, and then they rehab that. So they go in and they help you build new neurological pathways around your dead neurons. You can't make your neurons alive again. Dead neurons actually secrete chemicals that kill other neurons around them. So you have to get into one of these clinics as soon as you can, all right? And then, like I said, they fix your chemical imbalance. Your vestibular system, it's actually your earlobe fluid and balance, where you feel you are in space. So if you have vertigo, this can work for you. And you've seen me spin around in that machine. I was right brain injured, so I was basically, my brain was shutting down the left side of my body. And so they'll reset your vestibular system, and then, you know, you can move through life a little bit more comfortably, right? I don't like using the word treatment. I like using the word care, because the reality, we're all born with a certain amount of brain capacity, and once you lose that capacity, you can't get it back. But what you can do is build these new pathways, you know, so that you are being able to move. Your neurotransmitters aren't hitting a wall, and you're living a better quality of life, you know? Like, I'm outside right now in Florida with my son, and I have no glasses on. I couldn't do that 6 months ago because of my light sensitivity. I couldn't talk like this 6 months ago. I couldn't problem solve. I lost a business, you know, because of what was going on with me.
Daniel, how did this testing that's done at the Institute compare to baseline testing that allegedly players go through at the beginning of each season that's performed by the clubs themselves?
Oh, that's funny. It's so they do an impact test. It's a computer screen test. That's it. So it's the same test that I saw for 12 years. I went to 12 training camps. So what guys do is they memorize it and they fail it. Because you know that you're slowed down, right? That's one thing you do know about concussions. You don't know that three or more traumatic brain injuries, you're 80% more susceptible to early onset dementia, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's. Like, they don't tell you that. So if you don't understand the risks, what are you going to do as an athlete? You're going to do everything in your power that when you're hurt, to get back as quick as you can. So guys fail it.
Daniel, I listened to one of your interviews from a few months back, and you were pretty adamant in your belief that every NHL team should have a neurologist on hand for every single game, not just sometimes, but every single game, as opposed to an orthopedic surgeon or an athletic therapist. Why is that so important to you?
Because a neurologist knows the brain. An orthopedic surgeon knows how to reconstruct your ACL. That's it. An athletic therapist, he can get you back from a pulled groin pretty quickly. Shouldn't be diagnosing or touching my brain. It's that simple.
Daniel, I'll have to ask you about your Chapter 5 Foundation. What sort of impact have you already found it to have, and what impact are you hoping to have long-term with it?
I just want to educate. You know, I just want to help guys through some major stresses in life when you transition. And the first thing that I'm finding is that it's treatment. The answer isn't, oh, let's find you a job. You're not going to be able to hold it if you have mental health complications. You're not going to be happy. So the first thing, it's an ego death. Who are you away from the sport? Because there ain't 21,000 people in this parking lot that I'm standing in right now cheering for me. So if your happiness is attached to that, you're in trouble. Luckily for me, it wasn't. I was never like that. I love the connection with the guys. I like making playlists. I like taking the stress away from Johnny Toews and Kaner, who the press attack because they make so much money. If they don't play a certain way, then they get attacked. You know, like, so I just help, man. I try to help. That's it, you know, in a very informal process. And I don't talk about it. There's no testimonials because some guys don't want to talk about it. And I always say this, like, when they're ready, you know, when you're ready to tell your story because it could save someone else's life. And that's why I am so outspoken. I've got thousands of messages of people, you know, like thanking me and stuff. I don't highlight it because I try to help people without being found out. You know, like, that's what I like to do.
Daniel Carcillo is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Daniel, what do you say in response to the people who say you should have known that the sport you were playing was a physical sport and this is one of the, and you're very well compensated for playing in this sport, but this is, you should have known that this was a risk?
So you play for a $4.5 billion league, right? You think you're getting the proper care. Right, you really believe that, right? And you weren't. I say to those people, go research what this fight's about. Go read the 297 emails like I did. You'll understand the people that are running this thing are legit, I think, psychotic. Colin Campbell had a son who did the same job I did. Colin Campbell had the power and still has the power to make these rule changes and implement things that will better protect his son. And he didn't. That is, to me, the definition of a psycho. Gary Bettman's grandson plays AAA hockey. He has the power to make rule changes and to better help player safety. And he doesn't. So these guys are willfully killing their own family members. What do you think they're doing with us? You think they care about us? Give me a break, man. It's psychotic.
Last question.
Like, I want my day in court. I say it's not about money, and I'm dead serious because I want to look them in the eye, and I want to say this to them.
Last question for you, Daniel. We all know the names of the players, the young hockey players that we've lost because of brain injuries in some cases. I mean, certainly been documented that they have CTE. What's going to be the catalyst, the straw that breaks the camel's back? What's going to end up making the changes to the game that you're advocating so forcefully for? You know, we've lost players already. What's going to be the difference that finally results in tangible changes?
Fans are ingesting us, right? Right? You guys like watching hockey?
Mm-hmm.
Love it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? The Jets fans are very passionate. Start speaking up. Start getting educated, okay, and start helping these guys that have died at ages 28, 27, 35, 45. You know, if you want to ingest the entertainment, fans have a responsibility to help support players' health. I think it works hand in hand, and I don't think I'm being egregious when I say that.
Daniel Carcillo is a former NHL player, outspoken on the topic of player health. Daniel, appreciate your time. All the best going forward. We have a platform for you always if you ever want to come back and join us to advocate for your position.
I appreciate you guys having me, and I appreciate the support, and I appreciate the platform. So thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. When we come back, much more to come. We'll talk about that interview. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Saturday morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Daniel Carcillo for joining us. In case you missed any of that interview, and wow, I mean, that was a powerful interview. I mean, Daniel is certainly outspoken. He's making some claims that I don't know if they're correct or not. They're not verifiable on our end, but you know, he certainly believes, obviously, in his position. You know, outspoken about the NHLPA and its failing of the players. It was a tremendous interview from Daniel Carcillo. We're going to have it ready for you on TSN1290.ca and on our website, illegalcurve.com. We'll have it ready for you shortly. We'll get it posted in case you missed any of that. But tremendous, you know, he's outspoken. I'm sort of at a loss for words from what you heard from Daniel Carcillo there.
Yeah, and, you know, that's why we wanted to have him on, because, you know, if you follow him on Twitter, mm-hmm. and, you know, he is a great follow. His Twitter handle is CarBombBoom13 on Twitter if you don't already follow him. And, you know, with everything that's going on and, you know, with all of the points that he makes, Dave, about the NHL's concussion settlement, it's hard to argue with Carcillo when he talks about, you know, the amount of money that is being offered to all of these players. It's really a pittance.
Well, the problem is they didn't have the critical mass of players that, let's say, the NFL settlement had. They thought they'd have way more buy-in on the
right.
on the class action concussion settlement. So they didn't have that number of players. So you're right. The money that each player is going to get, $22,000 in a lump sum and then $75,000 worth of medical care, it's not a lot, especially if you have chronic long-term issues and injuries. It's not a significant sum of money. I mean, it's really interesting that you have this group of players who are outspoken, but you don't have the wave of players on it. And that's the you can see the, I mean, the sort of forces that are against each other, and that some of the players that you would think maybe would sign up. I mean, there's so many former players, it's a little odd, and I think it's still going to play itself out that not there isn't the critical mass and the critical swell of players jumping onto a concussion lawsuit like you saw in the NFL.
Yeah, but that also could be a little bit about hockey culture and that idea of, like, you know, and Daniel was talking about it, the idea of, you know, not rocking the boat and kind of sticking with the team. And you know, we see that throughout. And he's talked about it with the hazing issue and stuff like that, about how people stay silent and they just, you know, you don't want to be seen as kind of that guy who's an agitator. You mm-hmm. want to be part of the group. And maybe we see that in the post, you know, post hockey life as well, is that players don't want to be seen as the guy who's breaking ranks and, you know, because that's part of the thing. I mean, I've seen it. I've taken part in events here in Winnipeg where we've had former guys who play in the NHL, and they talk about those NHLPA events, and they talk about those teams that they still get together with. And perhaps they see if they join something like this, then they're going to be seen as outspoken and not really welcome at that because they're, quote, rocking the boat. So, mm-hmm. I mean, to be honest with you, I appreciated his honesty. I appreciated how candid he was with us.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really came through in the interview, and I think it's important because I don't think in the world of cliches that we generally live in, when you have someone who's outspoken, and obviously, look, he's got a perspective for a reason.
Yeah.
He obviously has dealt with a lot of health issues, so he has that perspective, and I think he's entitled to it, obviously. But I think it's interesting because he's really just advocating for safety. And to me, from that perspective, if you're an owner, And you can implement some of these things. And obviously, like, look, there's going to be a huge cost to it. I mean, we're talking about a business that's in, as he
yep.
touched on, in the billions of dollars.
Yep.
But to me, again, and it's all about feasibility and it's all about costs. I mean, there is a factor. You can't deny it. But his point is a good one. You know, I mean, we saw Dustin Byfuglien come back when he may probably shouldn't have come back.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is, like, perhaps something like this, is it plausible? Is it plausible to have, you know, a neurosurgeon sitting there waiting at every game? You know, that's going to be expensive. It's an expensive proposition for those guys, what they charge per hour to have them there for 3, 4, 5 hours every game. But you know, at the same time, you've got an athlete that's $10 million.
It's all sounds like what he's saying is that the teams don't really want the neurosurgeon there, and the teams don't necessarily want the answers that they're, you know, to the questions about brain health for their current players. I mean, he's making some very strong accusations, and I want to make it clear that his comments, especially about the NHLPA, were accusations. We don't know that they're necessarily facts, and that will obviously bear itself out over time. But, I mean, the passion and the advocacy that he has for this issue is tremendous. In case you missed any of the interview, again, like I said, we'll have it on tsn1290.ca. We'll have it on illegalcurve.com. We'll send out a link coming up shortly. When we come back from the Canadian Press, the national hockey writer Joshua Clipperton joins us for a look around the NHL. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN 1290.ca.